This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
Stay tuned for our bulletin of church news, which will be followed by Panorama, and then our feature, Culture and Society. We shall close with the news for young people. I am John Baptist Tumusime. The Catholic Church celebrated on Thursday, December 8th, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the Mother of Jesus Christ. According to the teaching of the Church, although Mary was human like us, she was conceived without original sin. Pope Pius IX declared in 1854 that Mary was granted with the extraordinary privilege because of her unique role in history as the Mother of God, and by this privilege, she received the gift of salvation in Christ from the very moment of her conception. Pope Francis echoed this theme on Thursday in his reflection before praying the traditional Nuno Angelus prayer with hundreds of the faithful who gathered in St. Peter's Square. Reflecting on Thursday's gospel reading taken from Luke chapter 1, verses 26 to 38, in which the angel Gabriel visits Mary's home and greets her as, "Hail, full of grace, the Lord is with you." The Pope noted that the angel greets her with a new name given to her by God, which is full of grace. This name, the Pope added, means free from sin.
Chiamandola con quel nome, Dio le rivela il suo segreto più grande.
The Pope said that by calling Mary full of grace, God reveals the greatest secret to her. The Holy Father said something similar has happened to us on the day of our baptism when our original sin was taken away. On that day, the Holy Spirit descended into our life and we became God's beloved children forever. Today, the Pope went on, Mary, who was surprised by the grace that made her beautiful from the first instant of her life, leads us to marvel at our own inner beauty because there is a greater good in us. The Pope invited the faithful to listen to the voice of God who assures us of His love, His presence in our lives, and of how important we are to Him. God is always on our side, he said, even when things do not go well, when we are discouraged, when we are downcast, and when we feel useless or wrong.
Custodire la nostra bellezza richiede un costo.
The Pope said to conserve God's grace in us, we are called to struggle with courage against sin by choosing good and rejecting evil. In this struggle, he said, prayer and entrusting our lives to the Blessed Virgin Mary are our main weapons. Later on Thursday afternoon, Pope Francis traveled to the Spanish Square in the city of Rome, where he prayed before the statue of the Immaculate Conception. In his prayer, the Holy Father called upon the Blessed Virgin Mary to intercede before God for the many people around the world who are facing challenges in their lives. He reminded the Blessed Virgin Mary that many come to her to thank her for the benefits they have received from God through her intercession. The Vice-Chancellor of the Catholic University of Cameroon, Father Joseph Awojum, has appealed to Catholics and people of goodwill within and outside Cameroon to contribute money and other necessities for students who have been affected by the civil war in the English-speaking provinces of the country. Speaking to reporters on Monday in the city of Bamenda, where the university is located, Father Jum said most of the students' parents had lost everything in the civil war and are unable to pay tuition fees, which the university uses to pay lecturers, to buy food, and to meet other demands of the institution. This is forcing many students to drop out. He thanked the donors who have helped and made a fresh appeal for more help so that the affected students can continue with their studies. The civil war in the English-speaking provinces of Cameroon started in 2017. It has killed thousands of people and displaced over 1.5 million others, with some crossing into neighboring Nigeria. The administrator of the Diocese of Wa in Ghana, Father Edward Tengan, has issued a statement announcing that the remains of Cardinal Richard Bawobri, the late Bishop of Wa, who died in Rome on November 27th, will be returned to the country in a month's time, that is on January 5th, 2023. The statement adds that the funeral and traditional rites for the late cardinal will take place on January 11th and the Requiem Mass on January 12th. The late cardinal arrived in Rome on August 26th on the eve of being created cardinal by Pope Francis. But he was admitted to hospital on that same day after the heart condition he had been suffering from deteriorated. The Pope created him cardinal in absentia. Earlier in July, he had been elected president of the Symposium of the Episcopal Conferences of Africa and Madagascar, an association that brings together all the Catholic bishops' conferences on the African continent. He was appointed Bishop of Wa by Pope Francis in 2016, a few months before he completed his term as Superior General of the Missionaries of Africa, commonly known as the White Fathers. He was the third Ghanaian cardinal after the late Cardinal Peter Derry and Cardinal Peter Turkson, who is still serving in the Vatican. You are tuned to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
The United Nations has reported that its investigation has found that 131 people were killed by M23 rebels at the end of November in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Most of the killings took place in the villages of Kishishe and Bambo in the Rushuru district of North Kivu province. According to the United Nations, the violence was carried out as part of a campaign of murders, rapes, kidnappings, and looting. The M23 rebels have denied the accusations and have instead blamed Congolese government troops and their allies of carrying out a genocide against the Tutsi community. It said in a statement on Wednesday that government-allied forces had killed, wounded, and displaced innocent Tutsi civilians, destroying houses, looting, and slaughtering their cattle. The government of Uganda said on Thursday that it had received 1,200 experimental vaccine doses from the World Health Organization against the Sudan strain of the Ebola virus that erupted in September in some districts. The country has confirmed 142 cases of the Sudan strain and 55 deaths. Currently, there is no vaccine for the strain. The doses of the experimental vaccine will be administered to people who have been in contact with those who have tested positive for the virus. Uganda's Ministry of Health said this week that there have been no positive cases in the country during the last 3 weeks, and this is a sign that the virus is under control. Researchers of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine have published findings showing that working in extreme heat by pregnant women poses health risks to the fetuses they are carrying in their wombs. The researchers monitored more than 90 women in the Gambia who worked in rice fields in direct sun and high humidity. They found that the heart rate of each mother's unborn child increased to dangerous levels. Similarly, the blood flow to the fetuses also slowed due to the impact of the heat on the mother's placentas. You are tuned to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
This is Culture and Society, and welcome to the program. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Povertism is the negative stereotyping of the poor. It is a major basis for denying people perceived to be poor their rights because of their social condition. Examples of situations when povertism is at play include employers judging curriculum vitae more harshly when an applicant's address is in a deprived area, landlords refusing to rent apartments to tenants who have no fixed income or those that are on government benefits. In some instances, school leavers are also judged on the basis of the school they attended when being considered for entrance to university or college training, with those from poor schools denied the preferential treatment being given to their more privileged peers. Just as racism, sexism, and other forms of discrimination should have no place in the world, povertism or negative attitudes and behavior towards poor people should also be illegal. Olivier De Schutter is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. His work consists in giving greater prominence to the plight of the millions of people across the globe who are living in extreme poverty. He recently told Florence Westergaard from United Nations News that poverty will never be eradicated while povertism is allowed to worsen, restricting access to education, housing, employment, and social benefits to those who need them the most. He said that the only effective way to eradicate poverty is by abandoning the charity approach in the treatment of the poor.
Being poor is not simply having insufficient incomes to buy the goods and services that allow you to lead a decent life. It is also being stigmatized. It is being looked down upon. It is being discriminated against in access to employment, housing, healthcare, and education. And that is also what people in poverty say when asked about their experience of poverty.
You have indicated that eradicating poverty requires building inclusive society that move from a charity approach to a rights-based empowerment approach. How would you describe this approach?
In many countries, support going to people in poverty takes the form of ad hoc cash transfer systems, providing people with some level of support to avoid them falling into extreme poverty. But these schemes are sometimes temporary. They do not provide people with entitlements they may claim before independent institutions. They are poorly financed. Usually the budgets available are insufficient to really cover the needs of all the population. And the targeting of these measures is sometimes very poor. Many people living in extreme poverty, in fact, do not have access to social protection because they face a number of obstacles, including not being registered in social registries, not being informed about their rights, not being able to fill in forms online. And as a result, those measures do not benefit the very people that should be supported by social protection. As long as we remain in an approach to tackling poverty that is based on charity from the state, and as long as we don't recognize that states have duties towards people in poverty who themselves are rights holders, we will fail to effectively address poverty. Poverty should be seen as a violation of human rights, and people in poverty should have access to recourse mechanisms if they are excluded from housing, from education, from access to jobs on a non-discriminatory basis, or indeed from social protection. And in many countries, this is difficult or even impossible to achieve. This is why my most recent report presented to the General Assembly of the UN is about protecting people in poverty from povertyism, from the negative stereotypes that affect them, the discrimination that they are facing in areas such as employment, housing or education.
Talking about banning povertyism, the same way than racism and sexism.
Indeed, for many years, we have recognized that racism, sexism, trans or homophobia should be outlawed, should be prohibited in legislation because they have no place in our world. Well, the same should be said about povertyism. In other terms, the negative treatment of people in poverty who are discriminated against simply because they live on low incomes, because they don't have the cultural codes, because they don't dress well, because they have the wrong accent. These are the indicators of poverty that very often lead employers not to recruit people, landlords not to rent their apartment to people in poverty, or that lead school teachers or school directors to exclude certain pupils from their classes or from their institutions. And so the report is about those many faces of discrimination that people in poverty face.
You advocate for social justice. Is this possible in a world of growing inequality?
It is possible to do much more against poverty and to do much more for social justice. But we need to acknowledge that low-income countries in particular have to be helped. A calculation of the ILO is that the financing gap to cover all people living in low-income countries, some 711 million people, with the full range of social protection floors, that financing gap is equivalent to about $79 billion per year. That is the equivalent of 15.9% of the GDP of these low-income countries. That is impossible for them to achieve. However, these $79 billion represent just half the total official development assistance provided by OECD countries to developing countries in the year 2019. So it is achievable if the international community wants to help and decides that social protection should be on the top of the global development agenda. This is why, together with the ILO, we have proposed the establishment of a new international financing mechanism, the Global Fund for Social Protection, and the International Labour Conference in June 2021 voted a resolution asking the International Labour Office to study how this fund could be put in place. The idea is very simple. Countries who pledge to establish social protection floors, protecting their populations from the risks of existence, from birth to death, from child allowances and maternity benefits to old age pension and including unemployment benefits, sickness benefits and so on. These countries, if they present a credible plan to finance social protection with support from the international community, should be able to receive such support. And they should, of course, also commit to invest by mobilizing domestic resources to protect their population from life risks and combined international support and the mobilization of domestic resources should allow these countries to implement Sustainable Development Goal number 1, the eradication of poverty, one of the targets of which is Target 1-3 about the universalization of social protection floors. That is something we can achieve provided the political will is there and provided we make this a priority for the international community.
Do you think that the eradication of poverty by 2030 is possible?
Given the food and energy crisis we are going through, the cost of living crisis that all countries are experiencing, of course, there is little room for being optimistic. The latest estimate is that the number of people in extreme poverty will increase by perhaps 95 million in comparison to the forecasts of 2019 as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, plus the food and energy crisis we are witnessing today. At the same time, these crises are a unique opportunity for countries to realize that there are many gaps in their social protection system. And I'm impressed by the fact that many countries have adopted social protection measures, expanding existing schemes or putting in place new schemes that were not existing before the crisis. And there is a renewed interest of governments in protecting their populations through social protection. So I believe this is an opportunity that can be seized if we provide the right funding, if we adopt a rights-based approach to social protection, providing people with entitlements they may claim, and ensuring that governments feel that they have duties towards people in poverty. Yes, we can significantly reduce poverty, if not eradicate it by 2030, at least make significant progress towards this objective.
United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Olivier Deschutes, talking to Florence Westergaard from United Nations News on the seriousness of poverty and how to overcome it by abandoning a charitable approach in the treatment of the poor. And that is all we have time for in this edition of Culture and Society. Until next week at the same time, my name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba.
And now, news for young people.
Hello and welcome to the program. I am Festus Tarawali. In this edition, UN Youth Envoy Jayatma Wickramanayake speaks about a key role young people can play in forging lasting peace agreements. An estimated 1.8 billion people in the world are between the ages of 10 and 24, and half of the world's population is under the age of 30. With these statistics in mind, Jayatma told UN News' Liz Cafidi that young people must be an integral part of the UN peace and security agenda, as you cannot build peace without engaging half of the world's population. She adds that young people are important to maintaining peace and security in communities and to building social cohesion. She began by explaining how the youth peace and security agenda of the UN has evolved.
The Youth Peace and Security Agenda is really a grassroots, bottom-up movement of young people asking the United Nations to recognize their role as active builders of peace. Because for so long, young people were considered as either perpetrators of violence, so as members of armed groups or terrorist groups, or as victims of violence in places affected by conflict. But majority of the young people in the world were saying that we don't belong into any of these categories, so don't use this binary definition to define us in peace and security contexts. Majority of us want to become youth peace builders, and we are already trying to build peace in our community. So Youth Peace and Security Agenda really came together with the voices of these young people coming to the UN, asking the UN and especially the Security Council to recognize their role as active and positive builders of peace.
How do youth and peace complement each other?
My argument or my thesis is that without engaging young people, we cannot achieve lasting peace. Currently, our world is youngest it has ever been. We have half of the world's population under the age of 30 and about 1.8 billion people between the ages of 10 and 24. You cannot build peace without engaging half the world's population. We cannot ignore young people as inexperienced or those who do not understand peace or those who should not have a seat at the table when it comes to building peace. Young people are important to maintain peace and security in communities. Young people are important to build social cohesion among different parties who do not agree with each other. But also, if young people do not grow up in areas, grow up in countries, grow up in communities where there is peace, they cannot realize their fullest potential. They cannot access education. They cannot access job opportunities. Therefore, they cannot realize their full potential and they cannot contribute to the economic and social development of their countries. So I think as much as young people are crucial to peace, peace is also crucial for young people.
What role can local young people play in peacekeeping and peace building?
We actually see the role of local youth groups in supporting peacekeeping efforts by the UN and peace building efforts by the UN in many parts of the world. We see young people organizing awareness campaigns online and offline. We see young people standing up for human rights, democratic values, free and fair elections in countries where the UN is also trying to build peace and continue our peacekeeping mandates. We see how young people bring different parties together, different parties who do not agree with each other. In places like Colombia, when the referendum for peace was called upon, it was the young people who were out there on the streets asking for parties to agree on a peace agreement. In the Philippines, it was young experts who played a key role in bringing the peace agreement together. In South Sudan, we have young people in the peace negotiations, in the follow-up of the peace negotiations, in the implementing committees of the peace agreement. So young people play a key role in ensuring peace in communities, but also in places where young people have been part of also the groups who perpetrated violence, they also have a key role when it comes to disengaging young people who are already engaged in violence and reintegrating them into society. So that peer-to-peer connection they have with other young people can help not only in raising awareness and advocacy, but also in disintegrating and reintegrating former combatants, for an example, into their communities.
That was UN Youth Envoy Jayatma Wickramanaike speaking there to Liz Kafidi of UN News.
Cry for peace loud and clear. And let the world know that we need it. You need it and we need it too. But not at all cost, yes, it's true. We pay the costly price for it. So we must now go for it. Yeah, it's my sign of peace.
You have been listening to the English Africa service of Vatican Radio, and I am Johnny Baptist Tumusime. In our next program at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature development and the economy. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.